Good afternoon, everyone. It's Pablo Zuanic, Equity Analyst at Zuanic & Associates. Welcome to this discussion around the scheduling process of cannabis. We have two speakers today in our panel: Kelly Fair, Partner at Dentons, and Morgan Fox, a Political Director at Normal. Also welcoming Anthony Coniglio. He's going to co-host with me this call, CEO of NewLake Capital Partners, and also a big thank you to NewLake for sponsoring this call. So welcome to all the speakers.
Thank you, Pablo. Thanks for having me.
So Morgan, I'll start with you here on the subject of the debate last night, right? Our call here is somewhat technical. We'll talk about rescheduling, the process, what may or may not happen, when and if. But just on the debate last night, the subject of cannabis did not come up. You know, why did it not come up, in your opinion? Were you surprised? And is this such a big campaign issue as we think of it in our own echo chamber of cannabis, right? Is it as such a big deal as other issues out there? Morgan, thanks.
Well, I think it's incredibly noteworthy that both of the presidential candidates are supporting cannabis policy reform in some fashion. This is a fairly historic development. That being said, I think that both of these candidates recognize that as popular as cannabis policy reform is, it's not necessarily a priority issue for the majority of voters. And so it's not particularly surprising that it did not come up during the debate. I think that we're going to continue to see this issue brought up again and again for the remainder of the campaign, but I don't think that it's going to be a tentpole issue for either candidate.
Understood. Kelly, your thoughts on the same question?
My thoughts are a little different. I thought it was an incredibly important moment coming into the debate, the weeks coming into the debate, that former President Trump changed his policy position on cannabis. And then it stayed in the news cycle with Vice President Harris calling it pandering. I think it will remain important around rallying the youth vote. I think Vice President Harris has a better grasp on the youth vote, so I wouldn't be surprised to see more messaging coming out of the Trump camp. Why I think it's important to our issue is because the former president has had very strong opinions on cannabis that were not favorable, not dissimilar to President Biden, where he was really dug in for personal reasons on cannabis. And it's his advisors and those close to him that have changed his mind. That's not going to be a bell easily unrung. So him coming out in support of Florida adult use ballot and SAFE Banking and rescheduling can kind of cool the jumpiness around would a President Trump second term really derail all the cannabis policy efforts. So I think still important.
Understood.
Yeah, Pablo, if I could, I'll just throw in 2 cents here. When I looked at that debate last night, certainly both candidates were looking for opportunities to draw a contrast with the other. And with the former president's comments coming out just a few days ago, there's really less daylight between the two of them on that stage. And had he brought it up, I think she would have saw it as an opportunity to potentially get a win and say, "Of course, I've been doing this for a long time." Had she brought it up, he would have said, "Yes, you know, you haven't done enough." And so I think there was not enough of just staying with the theme of last night, there wasn't enough attack opportunity for either side to really utilize it in that national stage as a wedge issue.
Yeah, no, I agreed. So again, for those of you that are joining, Anthony Coniglio is co-hosting the call with me, and we'll be asking some of the questions here. Of course, we'll delve more into more detail what may happen after the election, depending on the election outcome. Anthony, over to you with the next question.
So Morgan, let's start with you. You know, when we think about Normal's position around rescheduling, how are you all thinking about the approach to rescheduling? Also, do you plan on speaking or applying to speak at the hearing? Do you think that's a possibility? And then ultimately, what does Normal prefer? Is it rescheduling or descheduling? Where do you want to see this ultimately go?
Well, clearly we prefer descheduling, and I don't think that we're going to see any sensible cannabis policy coming out of Congress or out of the federal government in general until we actually do remove cannabis from the schedule of controlled substances. But that being said, rescheduling is certainly a positive step forward. I think one of the most significant benefits that it would have is that it ends the government's ability to rest on the definition of cannabis as a Schedule I substance in that it has no medical value and has a high potential for abuse. By removing the ability to fall back on that argument because of cannabis's Schedule I status, it really allows us to change the tone of the conversation around cannabis policy when it comes to Congress and when it comes to federal regulations. Now, obviously, I think that cannabis is eventually going to be regulated, but I think it's going to fall on Congress. If cannabis is removed from the schedule of controlled substances, then we're going to see Congress act to regulate it in some fashion, I think, fairly quickly, whether Congress is the body that deschedules or whether that's administratively. I have to say, I don't think that it's very likely for that to be done administratively in this case because of the structural inertia and long history of opposition to even moving cannabis to Schedule III at the DEA, which is ultimately the final arbiter absent a congressional action. The administrative process can certainly drag out. The first time that this process was entered into, it took 16 years before there was a final ruling. The last time it took about 5 years. None of these have been successful. I think we're in a much different paradigm now than we have been in the past. And obviously the information in support of cannabis's medical value and low potential for abuse is overwhelming. So an administrative move to keep cannabis in Schedule I is going to be pretty clearly politicized. But I think it is very important that we have this process underway right now so that we can not only change the way that cannabis is being discussed at the federal level, but also to reap the really the only practical benefits of a move to Schedule III, which is eliminating the 280E tax issue.
Yeah, but when you think about these ALG hearings that you just touched on, do you think normal is going to be part of that? I mean, you do have a history in some of these hearings of presenting fact before an ALJ, specifically within the DEA processes.
Well, in the past, we've been directly involved in the petition process, which is not the case this time around. We are certainly going to be applying to participate in the hearings. It's still a question of whether or not we'll be able to get standing. I think that that's actually going to be on the minds of a lot of people that want to participate in this hearing. Again, I think that the DEA is going into this with a very specific set of questions that they want elaboration on. And so I think that the people that are going to be most successful at gaining participation within this process are going to be the ones that directly address the issues that the DEA brought up in the proposed rule.
Yeah, that's probably a good segue, Pablo.
That's a good segue there for the next topic. So we'll move on to the technical aspects of the ALJ hearing. So Kelly, quite a few questions here. I will go one by one first. So why do speakers at the hearing have to apply again to speak? Did they not already ask for a hearing during the first 30 days of the public comment period? Just a quick answer on that.
Sure. So procedurally, the first bite at the apple was really a threshold question for the administrator. Should there be a hearing? Are there enough issues in opposition to the proposed rule that would mandate a hearing or require a hearing? There's usually a second opportunity for participants to try to state a notice of appearance or apply for a notice of appearance. And so once a hearing is determined to be merited, then the administrator has another opportunity to then set the participants and identify exactly who's going to be at the hearing and then designate an administrative law judge to then take over from there.
Understood. And just staying on that same question, in terms of making that decision, the DEA, whether the subject merited a hearing, do you believe there was DOJ involvement or do we know that for sure?
I think at this point, it's squarely in the hands of the DEA administrator. I mean, the DEA is giving its full focus to this. There's no reason to believe that the DEA has not given full focus and can certainly, walk and chew gum. I think that the attorney general wouldn't get involved as the boss unless something was going wildly awry.
Right. Understood. Okay. And let's talk about the criteria that the DEA will use to decide who speaks. How do they decide who has standing? And related to that, are only those negatively affected can speak at the hearing the actual wording says something like any person adversely affected or aggrieved by any rule or proposed rule issuable. Does that mean that people that are in favor of rescheduling cannot participate in the hearing as speakers?
So under the code, technically what you read is right. It should be those who are adversely affected by the rule. However, there are those that who requested a hearing that are taking the position that a different standard should be applied and that administrative law judges have applied a zone of interest standard before. And so if you or your membership has interest in the subject, they might be merited to have standing. We won't really know until we see the list of participants. If I'm looking at what the DEA wants right now, it's very broad until we see it scoped differently. It's evidence and expert testimony supporting the proposed rule. So there are those in opposition, but there are also cannabis industry association groups who have put forth and requested a hearing as well, or said, if there's a hearing, we should be allowed to participate. And if the DEA wants a full record of the evidence and expert testimony in favor of its proposed rule, as well as objections to the proposed rule, I think that there's discretion there built in based on precedent to allow adversely impacted and zone of interest. And there's an alternative argument for those who are in favor of rescheduling but want to participate to right. say we're actually in favor of descheduling. So we are technically adversely impacted by rescheduling. So we should have a chance to participate, at which point they are expected to submit evidence supporting medical benefit, low potential for abuse, and all of the good things that those in favor of the policy reform would want.
And in terms of the people that apply to speak at the hearing, is that going to be public information? Are we going to know who's applying to speak?
We will. We'll know who the participants are, certainly. And then watching the public docket, some participants are electing to mail in their requests. And so even with the comments, we're not exactly seeing all of them on the docket. So not sure if we're going to see everyone who's requesting to participate, but we'll certainly know the final list of participants. And at that point, we'll kind of know the scope of what's going to be heard, because right now we don't. It's very broad. It's evidence and expert testimony. But if you comb through the initial requests for hearings, there were some very nuanced things. There were those that have argued, you know, coherently that there's adverse impacts on certain cannabinoids by a reschedule without more in that rule. And other issues around treaty compliance and around medical benefit and potential for abuse. So we're not really sure exactly what the hearing's going to substantively look like. Seeing the participants will certainly help.
Right. And just staying on that point, so some people are applying by mail, right? So we won't know who they are. Others are applying publicly, so we know who they are. But roughly, the hearing is December 2nd. When will we know who has been granted the right to speak at the hearing?
So the deadline to request to participate is September 30th. In the notice, it's the administrator says that the DEA will take time to assess and come with a final list of participants. The DEA, as I have been told by, you know, former White House counsel, can walk and chew gum. I suspect they have an idea of who they want from that initial tranche of folks that applied for a hearing. I don't think it's going to take too long, because as soon as the participants are set, the administrative law judge will be designated, and then he or she only has until December 2nd to scope out what the hearing is going to look like, what right. the witness list is going to look like, or what's the deadline to submit memorandums of law and facts, all kinds of things that will come from there. So I would expect, looking back from December 2nd to November, early November, mid-November, we should know.
Right. Just staying on the same topic, and for those who are hearing through Twitter, it's Kelly Fair, partner at Denton, speaking. Could there be a scenario, Kelly, in which the DA reject all the speakers' request? Is that very unlikely?
Yeah. At this point, because we've gotten over the threshold, if the DEA wanted to reject all of this, it would have not granted a hearing, and it could have done so without a word and just moved right to final rule, and then everybody would just like be stuck with it. I think that given, not that this is a political issue, but given just the changeover in the slate and Vice President Harris running, I think that gave maybe some breathing room to the DOJ generally to run a very robust process here. Not having a hearing when you're expecting litigation on the back end, saying you had an arbitrary and capricious or somehow deficient process, having a hearing only bolsters the defensibility of the process. And so if I understand that with breathing room, that a hearing, you know, there was appetite for it. So I wouldn't expect a rejection.
Right. And again, I know you said that the administrator is the one driving the process, but maybe I'm repeating the question, but so the DOJ itself will not have any say in terms of who those speakers could be.
It'll be the DEA administrator, and like under the federal regulations and the code, it is the DEA administrator who can administer this process. It becomes very procedural, then passes off to the ALJ. The ALJ will have a lot of discretion how he or she wants to run his or her hearing or hearings, right. And then will pass back to the DEA for a final rule.
Right. Before I hand it over to Anthony on the same subject, Kelly. Do we know if the DEA acted unilaterally in terms of choosing December 2nd as a day for the hearing, or do you think that was something that was coordinated with the DOJ? And I don't know if we know this, but...
Yeah, I mean, everybody would want to know. Those who work in policy will tell you the DEA is a black box. They don't even share amongst the other agencies. You can try to crack in, but it's really hard to see their process. So just really don't know.
Right. Anthony, over to you.
Yeah, Kelly, I really want to pick at what you had just said. You said hearing or hearings. Can we pull on that thread for a moment? So do you think that they could accomplish what is needed given the large public interest in a single hearing? Do you think it would be multiple hearings since you used the plural word? And if it's multiple hearings, can you describe for us a little bit about how you would see that unfolding?
Sure. So scoping out the ALJ's mandate, whilst the ALJ has a lot of discretion, has to run an efficient and time-effective process. And so if hearings are granted on very disparate topics, I could see a scenario if I was an ALJ saying, you know what, this is going to be a separate hearing. It's going to have completely different expert witnesses. It's going to have completely different testimony. And it just wouldn't make sense to bifurcate a hearing, let's say, just pulling on examples, if you're having a hearing on medical benefit and potential for abuse, those tend to be packaged together. And then you are also going to grant some airtime for, you know, minor cannabinoids that are swept up in the rescheduling, like unknowingly or, you know, unfairly. You might just want to have a separate hearing on that. And what the ALJ is going to do at the very end is tie all of the testimony and all of this evidence into a bow and certify the record and pass it back to the DEA. So in future litigation, there's a closed universe of things that were considered. So it just depends how the ALJ's participation is gonna be scoped out, and that will largely be driven by the administrator.
Yeah, and I don't know that we've defined ALJ for everybody listening. If somebody doesn't know, it's administrative law judge. And so would it be just one ALJ that would be able to govern the multiple hearings? We don't need to worry about the DEA administrator needing to appoint another ALJ. You think we'd be able to use the same ALJ for all of these different proceedings?
Well, you look at precedent for this, and it would be completely reasonable to have one. I mean, this is a pool of Article II magistrates and judges that are very well equipped to do complex litigation. So I would expect it would be one ALJ appointed, and then it's his or her process to run.
And when you see the amount of interest in this, and when I read through a number of those requests for hearing, it seemed like there was a lot of content that people would put forth in the context of a hearing. I've seen some people speculate that it would be a one-day hearing. That seems completely unreasonable to me. I would expect this would go at least a couple of weeks, but you know, in your judgment, what do you think people should expect in terms of a duration of a hearing or hearings?
So to set expectations and thinking about that mandate to run things efficiently, one of the specific mandates under that bucket is to not allow duplicative or unduly time burdensome evidence. So everyone's comment is going to be automatically accepted as part of the record if they're participating in the hearing. And so it's not going to be a moment where someone could get up and filibuster forever about why they hate this policy move. It will have to have some efficiencies to it. And so that should give some comfort there. Said that, you know, you want to have a process that is actually robust enough to be defensible in the end. And so if we're starting at December 2nd, they got to wrap by the 20th to meet the holiday if they're going to do it in December, or the ALJ is going to recess it and it's going to move into January. So my gut is it's not going to be months and months, but a one-day hearing, if they've gone through all the trouble to set it up, is not likely. And if there's expert witness testimony, those expert witnesses procedurally have to be subpoenaed. The ALJ will sign the subpoenas. And there, you know, there's a certain amount of time that is required to serve the subpoena before you have to show up to testify. So there's some sausage to be made that I would think a one-day hearing would not.
I think this is great insight because it's really giving texture what's happening. And I've heard some people have concern that if some of the testimony is erroneous or just blatantly false, is there an opportunity for someone to step in and provide counter testimony to demonstrate that maybe there was false pretense or maybe there was contested testimony not to be taken as a rule, if you will?
Yeah. So theoretically, yes, there should be counterbalance, but this goes back to Pablo's question of who are they going to determine have standing? Like if they go very textualist and say only those adversely impacted, it could be a situation where it's only those objectors. But given the breadth that the DEA wants all of this information that supports actually the proposed rule that does propose to reschedule, I would expect there's going to be balance on the issues that are heard together. So balance on medical benefit, balance on likelihood of abuse, and the like. So, but we'll know as soon as we see who gets to participate, kind of what the battle's going to be. But to like, if we double click into that, if we get the right people at the hearing, there's going to be opportunity for cross-examination. It would be just like a trial, essentially.
And are there any
before you go on, Anthony? There, just I give Kelly a break here, but continue with the flow in 1 second, please. Morgan, for those listening, please remind them what is it that normal does, right? And going back to Anthony's question, given the relevance of rescheduling, why would normal want to participate in the hearing? I'm just coming back to the issue that, you know, who has standing, who doesn't. I would have thought normal would want to be involved, but just a reminder there, and then we'll come back to Anthony with his flow. Yeah.
Well, sure. Normal was founded in 1970 to protect the rights of cannabis consumers, and that's what we continue to do to this day, primarily through federal lobbying and grassroots organizing at the state level. And I think that as representatives of consumers, we would like to ideally get standing as representatives of people who are aggrieved by the status quo. Again, I think that it's kind of up in the air about exactly what sort of standard the DEA is going to use, whether it's Article 3 or Zone of Interest. But, you know, I think that it's important that cannabis consumers be represented in these hearings in some fashion. Of course, that's not really exactly what the DEA is looking for in this case. But sort of just to build on what Kelly said, I think we also have to be prepared for the possibility of procedural delays. You know, I think that given the letters sent by folks opposing the move to Schedule 3, specifically seeking delay, the fact that the political environment you know, in the administration as well as within the agency could very well be different after November and then much more so after January 20th. I think that people that are trying to maintain the status quo do have an interest in delaying this process as long as possible. So I think that regardless of even the DEA's best efforts to move expeditiously, you know, they do have a precedent of occasionally moving slowly in this process. And I think that we should also expect to see delays forced upon them because of participants or challengers to the normal flow of procedural progress.
Understood.
So let's pull on that a little bit more, because it's an interesting point. A lot of people in this industry are very focused on the process and everybody wants certainty. But I think what we're hearing here is everybody needs to have patience because there's no way you can have certainty to this process. On this point you're making about the delays, we know that the DEA administrator has a lot of latitude and the ALJ has a lot of latitude. But do we have precedent around procedural delays or injunctions before the hearings even get started? Is that a possibility that somebody could seek an injunction for the hearings? Or what are the things that can be done that would push the hearing back from December 2nd, other than the ALJ deciding they're not ready for it at that point?
You know, I'm not incredibly familiar with the details of some of the previous petitions and the manners in which they were delayed, but I think that the hearings would actually have to start before motions could be made in order to provide any sort of procedural impediments. But I think I'm also very concerned about even after the final rule is issued, regardless of what that may be, there are going to be legal challenges that could again stretch this process out for an indeterminate period of time.
Sure. Kelly, did you want to weigh in on anything regarding that?
I think Morgan nailed it. Like, there's no, it's not ripe yet. It's not ripe until someone's been harmed. And even after the final rule, like establishing standing, if you're before the right judge is going to be difficult because we're not talking about descheduling. We're talking about rescheduling. And there's no, rescheduling means that there'll be new pharmaceutical application for THC that does not yet exist. And for Article 3 standing, you have to have actual harm, nothing that's hypothetical or conjecture in the future. So it's just before the right judge, it will be a difficult argument to make. I've been challenged on that point to say, yeah, people forum shop all the time. And given like some judges, you know, are kind of salivating over the Loper decision, maybe they would take it up anyway. But it will be difficult to make that standing argument. Even
on that point, in the case, there was a case recently with psychedelics in which I think the DEA had to delay the start to a hearings because there was a judicial challenge, right? Could that happen in this case? Because I think we are talking here about judicial challenges after the fact with the final ruling. But in terms of, could there be judicial challenges now before the hearing that could delay the start, that could delay it beyond December 2nd?
So as my civil procedure professor, my first year of law school said, you know, what does it take to file a lawsuit? $300. Anyone could file a challenge. And then it might take time to throw that challenge out or, you know, just get it out. I can't see one going on the merits, but yes, there is a possibility. But at this point, those who would be challenging the hearing are also probably the same people that asked for the hearing. So we get in kind of a world of the absurd pretty quickly. I think everyone wants to be heard on this issue. More likely scenario for me is we get through the hearing, we get to a final rule. Within 30 days, there's a lawsuit filed. We'll see who has standing. There's injunctive relief sought. You have to prove out that you're more likely to succeed on the merits of that lawsuit at that point and see if that wins. I mean, that's really a 2025 problem for me.
Right. Anthony, carry on.
Yeah, when we think about rules, and you could look to banking rules, you could look to energy department rules, often you'll see a proposed rule, there'll be a discussion, and then they'll revise the rule a little bit. This proposed rule is quite simple in that it moves something from Schedule 1 to Schedule 3. Do you foresee something where maybe there's another interim rule that comes out as another proposed rule where they modify what's being proposed? And I'm not talking about deciding that it goes to Schedule 2. I'm saying they'll continue to recommend Schedule 3, but add some other rules around that, which would then put us back on the clock for another proposed rule and another round of comments and potential hearings.
What I think is more likely, and I'd like, I mean, Morgan, please jump in too, is that the final rule is going to look a little different because it's gonna incorporate existing rules that relate to cannabis around the DEA's ability to control this close supply chain of DEA registered cannabis production in the US, things that will continue to relate to treaty compliance and make sure that the processes that are in place today under Schedule 1 follow cannabis down to Schedule 3. So it's not just an open field to be able to supply API into the pharmaceutical chain. So I think it will look different. But as you say, it is a very simple first jump. And like, unless it was to deschedule or go to a different schedule, I wouldn't expect an interim role.
Okay.
Yeah, I completely agree with Kelly. I think that when the DEA finally releases its final rule, it's going to contain a significant amount of additional regulation that they really teed up in the proposed rule anyway. I think that it's anybody's guess exactly what that will look like. But we do know, as Kelly mentioned, that some of it is going to relate to treaty compliance. Some of it is going to relate to maintaining tighter restrictions on cannabis than on other Schedule III substances. But I think that it's really anybody's guess what the details of those regulations are going to look like, which is, I think, a fairly terrifying prospect, but not necessarily one that is going to eliminate the basic impact that we expect Schedule III to have, which is, in practical terms, the elimination of 280E, and in symbolic terms, the change of the conversational paradigm.
Great.
Thank you. So just staying on the same subject, once the hearing is done, Kelly, how long does the AL judge take to write her or his report? Do we know what is done? Is that a public document?
We don't really know what that report is going to look like. Technically, under the rules, what the ALJ has to do is certify the record and has to get all of the evidence together, certify what happened at the hearings, and pass it back to the DEA. Will the ALJ have, findings of fact and law as part of that? Perhaps. But again, we won't really know. And we won't really know the probability of that until everything's scoped out. I think that it's a lot to put on an ALJ to say, does cannabis have medical benefit? And remember, and I meant to say this earlier, just around will there be counterbalances in these hearings? We already have a counterbalance very much in favor of rescheduling on the major factors, the medical benefit and likelihood of harm through HHS. There's a 225 page plus file that's sitting out there with a lot of evidence. So don't know if the ALJ is going to be required to write something or order something. It will be a recommendation to DEA. There's no time clock for that process. It really will depend, what is the ALJ's mandate? If it's just to certify the record, a record can be certified in a matter of weeks. That is just a technical administrative thing to do to button up the record. And then thereafter, the rules say that the DEA, within a practicable time period, shall issue the final rule. So again, a lot of discretion in there.
Yeah, I think it's also important to note that there is precedent for the DEA ignoring the recommendations of the ALJ. I don't necessarily think that that would happen in this case, but it is a possibility.
Right. And then in terms of I'm going to read some questions that are coming through here by email and Twitter, but someone is asking, whoever wrote the HHS document, right, I suppose senior staff there, can they also speak at the hearing? Or that doesn't make sense because they are part of the process itself?
If they're subpoenaed, and this is something I'd want to double click into, if they have some sort of protections around their process. Yeah. But I think the subpoena field is kind of open once we get the participants on and get the hearing scoped out. Their recommendation will be part of the record, though, and that file will be part of the record. So I don't know that you would get to the work product process, first of all, just under privileges. But if you get the file in as part of the record, you wouldn't really need someone to there other than to verify that is the, verify the veracity of the documents.
Right. Look, and I know you touched on it, but assuming that the AL judge writes a report, obviously the DA and DOJ cannot write the final rule without having received that document, right?
If it's part of certification of the record, that's correct. Like, the DEA cannot write the final rule until the record's been certified. And if it's being held up by some memorandum of law and some order, then yes.
Right. And Kelly, in your opinion, would the election outcome impact how quickly the DEA and the AL judge complete the process, the hearing, the ALJ report, and the subsequent application of the final rule? report?
I'm sorry, could you repeat the question?
No, I mean, would the election outcome impact how quickly the DEA and the ALJ judge complete the process, the hearing, by the process, I mean the hearing, the ALJ report, and the subsequent publication of a final rule? I mean, is there, assuming that they want to get this done before January 20th, right? Does the election outcome speed up the process in any way from the DEA side? Or do you find that it's totally independent?
Well, I would try to have the discipline to say this is not a political exercise. This is not the assignment. The assignment is to go through a process that's robust enough to be defensible at the end. And so I think that having a December 2nd hearing gives the opportunity to finish by the end of January, and certainly by an administration change. But I don't know that that's the mandate. The danger of going beyond that is if there is a new administration, if it's a Trump second term, then you're going to have executive branch changeover. And so changeover, no matter what, could create some delays. With former presidents, stated and very public stance unequivocally supporting rescheduling, I don't think this is going to be his day one issue to try to knock this off the rails. I mean, he's kind of married to that policy unless he completely waffles. So I would expect things to stay on track. Morgan, I don't know if you have a different gut sense. I mean, we all have to work on our spidey senses around these issues.
Yeah, I think my primary concern is going to be changeover in terms of agency heads in either case. I think that is really the only thing that could potentially impact the timeline in any way. I think that if we maintain the status quo in terms of management at DOJ and at DEA, then the process will continue moving apace. I don't think it will be accelerated or slowed down particularly by anybody. But again, if the Attorney General is replaced or if Ann Milgram is replaced, that could potentially impact the process. Whether it's sped up or slowed down, I think that that's anybody's guess. I think that it's anybody that's that has a prediction on this is really just guessing at this point, because I think it's going to depend really heavily on the people that are appointed, particularly in the case of Trump, where we've seen that even with some positive statements in the past, people that have been appointed to positions that are gatekeepers in this area have been fairly anti-cannabis. Talking about Jeff Sessions and Bill Barr, the likelihood of getting somebody that is supportive of this change, and I think is probably pretty low with a Trump presidency. So then it would really depend on exactly how much political capital a President Trump in a second term would want to expend on this issue in terms of promoting it and supporting his campaign promises.
Yeah, so just staying on that point, and I know, as you said, guesstimates or best estimates, I'm gonna push the argument there and just say, I mean, for you, Kelly, first brief answer, probability that a final rule is actually published before January 20th, or this is very unlikely?
Probability that it's before? I mean, I was wanting to say we'd get a final rule and no hearing by September before the election. So I'm going to stay optimistic. I'm going to be, my optimism will wane or get more bolstered around how they scope out this hearing, because I think it can be done if it's scoped right. And there is focus and there's really no duplicative evidence and all of that. And like it's buttoned up tight. I think it can be done before the December holidays and then finished in January.
Morgan, do you want to add anything to that question in terms of the probability or?
I mean, given the history of this process, and I know that there are a lot of factors that are quite a bit different than in the past, but I would be fairly surprised if a final rule was issued before January 20th. It's entirely possible that it would be, but again, I do think that we would see legal challenges at that point that could stretch the process out of actually finalizing that rule in practice for quite some time.
Right, but just to be clear, I mean, once the way the process works, once a final rule is published, there's a 30-day period, right, before it becomes official or it's implemented, right? And during that 30-day period, you can have judicial reviews. Anthony, I think you have some questions there on that subject. So go ahead.
Yeah, yeah. So for my two cents, I'll take the over on January 20th. So I love that Kelly's being optimistic. Yeah. We all want to be optimistic, but unfortunately, very few things around cannabis land happen with relative speed. But staying with this kind of point in the cycle where we now have a rule coming in place, can we talk a little bit about that seeking of stay? Because I think a lot of people want to understand, all right, what are the obstacles that people can put up? So what could be the arguments that people would challenge this proposed rulemaking? And what would some of the Circuit Court of Appeals be more sympathetic to for those seeking a stay? And I guess, how does Chevron play into that? We saw that play in last week to a hemp ruling. And how do you think all that plays in?
So I think that if you look at some of the opposition's comments, you're seeing kind of the best bad arguments by very smart lawyers on standing. Like, you're talking about being harmed by a Schedule III pharmaceutical that doesn't exist yet. There is the benefit that Morgan's, you know, alluded to a couple of times, that it makes this policy reform moment is big for our industry, and it's giving legitimacy to cannabis. And so the argument would have to be, we and our members are harmed because cannabis has been given the legitimacy of having medical benefit and having a lower likelihood of addiction. And so I think that's the best argument that could be put forward. And like my colleague in Chicago said to me, to, you know, rebut that, to say, like, you could form shop your way to someone who wants to get their hands on an agency action. And then, you know, that standing's established. Getting an injunction after that, you have to also, you know, overcome the hurdle that you've got a likelihood of success on the merits of your case, that this rule is going to be like absolutely, you know, ripped up and thrown away. So it's going to be a battle. I would like to say it's going to be one that's lost and that the rule stays in place.
Yeah, but it certainly doesn't mean people won't try, right?
They're going to try, delay things, and it will make 280E application much less certain and more messy. It will make, you know, those that want to handle pharmaceutical application of THC and develop those drugs, it's going to slow that down. But because we're not talking about descheduling, it's not all the things that the industry needs. So
I honestly also think that we might see some challenges that are more substantive in nature, you know, alleging that the potential for abuse was potentially understated during the hearings, or that the science is still not out yet, and so it's impossible for the DEA to make an accurate ruling on this. You know, I think that in terms of the substantive issues, the potential for abuse is something that the people that want to maintain Schedule One status have really been focusing on. So I would not be surprised if they continue to challenge on that point.
And I've seen a compliance. If they overcome standing and say, like, established harm in the first instance, Morgan's exactly right. And treaty compliance is a very complex issue that I think can be won by the DEA, and the DEA has precedent of using its discretion under the CSA to change the marijuana quotas, to reschedule Marinol. I think same statute was used, but that's going to be a big one too.
And a lot of people, I'm sorry, I just lost my thought. Oh, a lot of people have been looking at hemp as an opportunity for bringing into the argument that, you know, hey, we've legalized hemp and it's the same plant. Do you think there's any there?
I'll let you start there, Morgan. I know that hemp and cannabis are kind of a dicey issue.
But Anthony, are you asking the question from the point of view that they would participate in the hearing, or just more in general?
Yeah, yeah.
That's a good question. You know, I'm really not sure of the answer. I think that given the federal government's definition of hemp versus cannabis, and the fact that they've, you know, effectively are not on different schedules now, or one is rather descheduled, I'm not sure would really qualify people for standing if they were representing from a market or a position of interest directly related to something that is not the substance in question that's under schedule review.
Yeah, and practically, just the way the policy lines are drawn, it's usually the cannabis industry attacking the hemp industry, not vice versa. Hemp's got its own fights to fight just to get products on the shelves. There's, you know, the FDA regulating the CBD, the states are banning a lot of the hemp-derived products. So I haven't seen, and we didn't really see it in the comment period, that the hemp industry stepping up to say, no, you know, we're the legitimate plant and we're the legal plant. You know, this plant shouldn't have any more deference in Schedule One.
Yeah, that's always the case in this particular issue. Significantly different if you're looking at Florida.
True.
No, for sure. So look, I know we're on 45 minutes already, but we have a bit more to cover here. Just on the subject of the call memo, right? If I go back to the original call memo, there was no rescheduling or scheduling process, right? So right now we have all assumed that once rescheduling has been done, that could be followed by, you know, a call memo 2 or a Garland memo that could provide safe harbor to banks and other services providers that work with the industry, or that could try to resolve or address some of the tensions between this conflict of a federal rule and state rules being different. But could there, on that point, Kelly, or both of you, could there be a scenario in which we have a call memo now in the lame duck, right? A call memo 2 in the lame duck, on the assumption that the rescheduling process and the final rule could drag on, that process could take a while? Or do you think it's very unlikely we will have a Garland memo before rescheduling is completed?
You know, I've always seen a call memo 2.0, as we shorthand it, as a separate work stream altogether. I mean, that really is targeted at giving relief to the cannabis industry, where rescheduling is a win for the cannabis industry and gives tax relief. It won't do the safe harboring that you're describing in a Cole memorandum. That work stream, which is sitting with the DOJ, is obviously, we don't have a Cole 2.0, but I understand that those that are staying close are optimistic to see one, whether it's before rescheduling or not. I don't see them interrelated or dependent upon each other. What's being discussed is expanding the Cole memorandum to safe harbor other even agencies around entitlements, get some social equity provisions in there, like give relief as broadly as possible, given that we're not looking at a descheduling for cannabis.
Right. But on that point, I mean, and this is hypothetical, I know, but let's say that, you know, Vice President Harris loses the election, right? DOJ, AG Garland knows that he's going to be out of a job. Could they try to, like, come out with that memo on the assumption that it will not be rescinded this time?
I mean, if it's done, but then you saw what happened, with Sessions pulling down the Cole memorandum. Right. So it's like, what can be done can always be undone. So I would say that's just how close they are to really, like, rolling out that policy reform.
Right. I mean, Morgan, I'll let you answer that also. But I mean, I guess I asked a question on the assumption that what comes out in Truth Social is true, right? So based on the tweets that we've seen in Truth Social, the assumption, my interpretation would be that if there was a call memo, it wouldn't be rescinded this time. But I know it's hypothetical. Anyway.
Yeah, I think that's a really good question. My instinct is that no attorney general appointee would want to do anything that could potentially limit their power to prosecute people that they want using any laws that are available to them. I think that if AG Garland were to institute a Cole Memo 2.0 or anything official, any incoming attorney general in the next administration, if Trump is president, may have an incentive to repeal that, just because it was, you know, the last guy's outgoing move. Not to mention the fact that I think there is that political dynamic, which President Trump actually expressed himself that Congress was working to prevent DOJ from actually being able to enforce federal cannabis laws against adult use states, as they have been against medical states for the last, I guess, since 2014, that was not legally binding for him or his Department of Justice. So I think, you know, it's possible that it wouldn't be rescinded, but I think that it would, the threat is there. Not to mention the fact that I think that an outgoing AG Garland might not want to try to institute something that there was a serious possibility of being repealed as soon as he walks out the door. conversely, if Vice President Harris wins the election, I don't think that there's any real motivation to move quickly on the part of the DOJ to institute a Cole 2.0. I think that that would be something that would probably happen further down the road in the first term, but, you know, potentially in the first year. But they haven't really been in a hurry to do so during the entire Biden administration. So I'm not sure what the motivation would be for them to do so if Vice President Harris wins.
Right, understood. So now we want to move on to discussion to specifically that subject, right? What happens if candidate Trump wins? What happens if candidate Harris wins? Anthony, I'll let you start with your questions on the hypothetical that Trump wins.
Yeah, so we know what he said in his Truth Social post. What do the two of you think that he would actually do? You have any predictions based on his track record or based on the direction you see the government going?
I can just briefly jump in to say that Morgan made the right point at the beginning. It depends how the agency heads like unfold. I don't think that he's going to take on the issue like a President Harris might, or like to push Congress. I think Congress is going to be the real driver, like if it's a Harris administration. But I wouldn't expect Trump to get very active kind of either way. I don't think it's going to be his day one mission to stop rescheduling or like stop anything, but I don't know that he's going to take it on as like his pet priority.
Yeah, I agree with that assessment. I don't think that a President Trump is going to view this as a particularly high priority issue, especially once he's in office. And I think it's going to largely depend on the people that are appointed to positions that are directly related to these policy areas. Also, I think that if there is a Democratic Congress while he's president that is actively passing this legislation, he may have a political incentive to slow it down or at least not be as supportive. But all of that, I think, is really just a lot of conjecture. With a Harris victory, I think that we'll see a lot more ownership of the issue, but it really depends on how much political capital again is willing to be spent by that administration to move things in an expedited manner, or whether that ends up being a priority, which is going to be affected by a lot of things that are completely unrelated to cannabis.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
With the Harris administration, you can see what happened under a Biden administration. This is as far as the executive branch can go. There's no pen stroke that's going to deschedule this plant. She could like kick off a whole nother process, but why? She's going to be taking credit for the rescheduling once it happens. I think she will be looking to Congress to make any further policy reforms at that point and really be in a pretty justified seat to do that.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And before the former president's recent tweets, his recent posts, regarding support for Schedule 3 and Amendment 3, there was some worry that if a final rule happened before the inauguration, that the Administrative Review Act, I think it's called, would have allowed the new Congress to be able to look at that rule and unwind it. We understand there's some procedural rules where you have to get it through both the House and the Senate before you get it to the president's desk, and there was some question there. Do we all agree that that's kind of off the table now? It wouldn't seem like, based on these statements, that even if it did get through a House and Senate and they felt that that was a political priority, that he's more likely than not to veto that if it ever did make it to his desk. So I view that as a really unlikely event. Would you agree with that?
And now with his recent statements, yes. And it was a big worry. It was, you know, we lost the calendar in August. Like, yep. that review is going to get kicked into the new administration anyway. But when you actually double click on the CRA and like what has to happen, it's basically passing a law. So it's got to get through both chambers of the House, and then it's got to get to the president's desk. And if it is a Trump second term, like, it just doesn't seem like that would be a priority, that he would need to push his Republican leadership to really rally together to get it through either of the chambers. It just doesn't seem
right. And in the first 60 days, wouldn't seem like that's a political priority in your first 60 days of the new session.
Right. Yeah. And it's 60 days once the rule is in place. So mm-hmm. Congress just needs to have 60 calendar days to have a crack at it and see if they're going to take on opposition.
Pablo, hand it back to you.
Yeah, thank you. And then just to be clear, in terms of the on the assumption that Vice President Harris wins the election, from a statute point of view, can she be scheduled via executive order, or that has to be done through an act of Congress?
She cannot reschedule.
She cannot.
What she can do is kick off a process that we saw under the Biden administration, where it's HHS review back to the DOJ, to the DEA. But that's the extent of the executive branch's powers under the CSA.
Right. Okay, but she could deschedule via an administrative process of the executive branch, right? And the other way to deschedule would be doing it through an act of Congress. I mean, if you can get these votes.
Right. Yes, but the ultimate decision, if it's done administratively, is up to the DEA. Now, obviously, if a DEA administrator is unwilling to do that, they can be replaced. But that doesn't mean that you still don't have to go through the petition and the review process, just like we're currently in the midst of.
That's right.
But as Kelly stated, I think that what the president can do, and I think what would be most effective would be to pressure Congress to pass descheduling and regulatory legislation.
And we don't really know where HHS is. I mean, we can guess where Becerra is on the issue, but we don't know if it, given where the science is and given how stunted the science has been to schedule this plant, like, could they get to a deschedule through the process is also, it's a bit of a wild card. I really think that it's time for us as advocates to be on the gas to pressure Congress to get one of the bipartisan bills through at some point to deschedule this
session. Well, Secretary Becerra, in his testimony, I think we all saw a few months ago, didn't even know how many schedules there were. And he wasn't even really familiar with the schedule. So yeah,
from California, so I have to say that, but yes.
Yep.
In terms of a potential President Harris could do to speed up the process, could she appoint a new DA administrator? Would that make sense? I mean, given all the many things she's going to have to do initially if she's elected president, would that make sense? I mean, would you expect a change of DA administrator, and could that speed up the process? Doesn't seem like it would be a big priority, right?
I think that, Ann Milligram's done her job, and I'm rarely right. For those that are banking on my bullish predictions of when this is all going to get done, she really did deliver, and she really did put out that proposed rule before or in May. And so, like, she's done her job. I wouldn't see a reason to not. If there was obstructionist behavior, then maybe, but.
Right.
I'm just guessing at this point.
And just to stay on that point, and I'm here paraphrasing based on the questions that we're getting, but I think in the case of Secretary Becerra, he was going to try to run for governor of California. I don't know what happened with that. But in the case of the DEA administrator, Ann Milgram, do we know right now what she's doing after this administration? I mean, assuming that the same, that Vice President Harris is elected president and she's reappointed. I mean, has she... Again, in the case of Secretary Becerra, my understanding was that he was stepping down and he was going to move on to something else. Has anything like that come out from Ann Milgram's side in terms of what she may be doing next, or we don't know?
Don't know. Not from my seat. Like I said, the DEA is the ultimate black box of trying to figure out what right. They're doing as an organization and what any individual is doing. I think Mr. Booz is the most, public and vocal of any of them on, his positions, but that's as far as I know.
Right. Look, I mean, this is just, I'm going to jump around here in terms of questions that are coming through, but someone asking, this whole process regarding the Boies lawsuit, right? Can that have any impact on the rescheduling process, or they're just separate rails? Any thoughts on that? How that may play out and whether it impacts rescheduling in any way? Morgan,
separate rails. The only precedent that I'm looking at and that most lawyers are looking at is the new Loper precedent. And depending on how the rule goes, there's variation between what an agency does to under statute to create a new rule versus application of fact to an existing rule, and where this lands as between Loper and Skidmore. Under Skidmore, you get some more deference if you're statutorily given authority to create a rule. So That's more, I think, the focus now.
Right. And Morgan, just want to come back to you on a point you raised before. And again, this is paraphrasing questions that I'm getting, but you know, the idea is that why would you want to burn too much political capital on this, assuming that Vice President Harris is elected president? If the rescheduling process is moving along and not dragging on too much, you know, let's say it takes another year, she would just stick with the rescheduling process, right? But if not, and maybe leave the scheduling or something bigger for later on. I mean, do you agree with that assessment, or could they get, you know, she said in the past publicly that she's in favor of the scheduling. Is that something that she would like to, if rescheduling get to say so long, takes so long, maybe she just says, well, let's drop it, let it die there, and let's just go and get the scheduling done. Do you see that playing out? And again, I know there's a lot of hypotheticals there.
Yeah, I think that what's most likely to happen is that we would see some pretty strong public statements in support of descheduling, as well as pressure on Congress to move in that direction more quickly. I'm skeptical that a President Harris would initiate a new scheduling review to push for descheduling administratively. Again, it's possible, but I tend to think that that would be the least likely of the viable options. I think you know, public support and congressional pressure are much more likely.
I think it's also important when people talk about descheduling is to understand what else needs to come with descheduling. So let's just pretend that she pushes Congress to deschedule and Congress goes to do it. The bill doesn't say we will deschedule. Congress will seek to implement a regulatory regime over the product. So you now have to get into which agency will regulate. Does this sit in the FDA? How does the budgetary process work? I think there's a lot of other stuff that goes along with descheduling. I doubt that there's a scenario where you would get descheduling and, oh, just go do what you want. I think it would come with a tremendous amount of regulation, and which ends up leading to a tremendous amount of legislation that would be required.
Well, I think that it really depends upon who it is that's passing the legislative body that ends up descheduling cannabis. You know, right now we've got vehicles that are very simple, clean descheduling bills that really leave it up to the states and don't include any sort of regulatory language. We've got bills that, like the States Reform Act, that have, I think, a pretty robust but also fairly streamlined and limited regulatory structure, as well as really low tax rates. And then you've got legislation like the MORE Act and the Cannabis Administration and Opportunity Act that have a lot more regulatory structure and a lot more additional language than just a clean descheduling. I really do think that it's going to depend on who finally passes this legislation. I do think that once cannabis is descheduled, regardless of the vehicle, that we are going to see continued legislation to regulate the substance as well as regulate the industry surrounding it. But I think it's highly dependent on the vehicle that initially deschedules it to see what that looks like, and also to chart the path of what it's going to look like going forward after that, as we start seeing additional changes being proposed.
Look, I know that we're over the hour here, and we very much appreciate your time. Just two or three more questions only, and again, trying to paraphrase different things I'm getting here.
Unfortunately, I really do have to jump. I'm on a bit of a deadline, but thank you very much for having me. Thank you for speaking with us, Kelly. I'll talk to you later.
Stay with us, Kelly. I mean, but thank you, Morgan.
Okay, I'll stay.
All right. Kelly, you know, just in terms of a question of someone asking, given the comments in the past, you know, when we talked about safe banking or other types of reform that we have to be passed through Congress, we always talk about, you know, the 60 votes, right? Can you get 60 votes? Do you think that, you know, former President Trump's recent comments may sway some of those Republican senators to be more in favor of whatever it may be, safe banking, the States Reform Act, or other legislation, or his views are not really representative of a lot of those senators in on the subject?
I do. My comments at the top, it's why it was so important, his comments today. Like every air of legitimacy that the most conservative part of the Republican Party sees for cannabis, and like whether it's coming from former President Trump or now it's rescheduled and not sitting next to LSD and heroin, that will make those that are more conservative come closer to the fold to say, okay, it's not legalized. Maybe it's not legalized, but it's not heroin. It's not so bad. And I mean, even J.D. Vance has said he hates cannabis personally, but maybe the states can just handle it. Like, there's also in the conservative part of the Republican Party, there's the libertarian bent and the states' rights bent that might just say, let the states deal with this. And it's not heroin, you know, and, you know, and former President Trump is supportive. So all of those things are add up to all good things for getting more policy reform in the pipeline.
And one last one on my side, and Anthony, I don't know if you have one last question, but in terms of a farm bill, right? And I know that here there are many hypotheticals, right? Who is the next president? What does Congress look like, right? But, you know, they are supposedly, in terms of a farm bill 2025, supposedly more Republicans in favor of hemp derivatives, right? And then supposedly more Democrats in favor of cannabis legislation. I know I'm oversimplifying when I say that, but if that's the case, do we see room for a compromise in 2025? So, and the way I think about it, you know, isn't there a window for broader legislation through Congress where you could actually get the two sides to agree? Because one side wants to get that farm bill done with some provisions, and then the other side wants to get cannabis legislation done. Maybe this is the time to come together and get it done. But if the administration is focused on just, let's say, Harris administration is just focused on getting rescheduling done, you miss that window. And I know I'm making a lot of assumptions and hypotheticals as I say that, but any thoughts on that? I just find the window to get it all done together. But
it's the right question, because it's, you know, what Tony, you know, foreshadowed is it's all going to, or and Morgan too, it's all about the regulation and who's going to be the primary agency of jurisdiction over cannabis when it deschedules and over hemp in the short term. And so you're seeing the activity around the farm bill and activity in independent legislation that wants to legislate hemp-derived CBD and hemp-derived intoxicating products in a certain way. And we've got some agencies that are vying for control over cannabinoids. And so I think in the cross section of that effort, I think we might see that window. But there's also a thorny part of that discussion, which is there are conservative Republicans that were pro legalizing hemp that didn't see the intoxicating product issue coming. And there are bad actors in the market that have done bad things, like have very intoxicating products that are marketed to children that are sold outside of the dispensary chains. And so it's a very complicated playing field for these issues. But in there is regulation. And in that regulation, it does bring both hemp and potential cannabis in the future to the table, and Republicans and Democrats on both sides.
Right. Anthony, any closing remarks or closing questions on your side?
No, this has been a fabulous conversation. Kelly, thank you. Morgan, you've left already, but thank you very much. I think this has been really illuminating and a terrific discussion.
You're welcome. I'll come back anytime. After the 30th of September, we'll know more.
We'll take you up on that. Kelly Fair, thank you very much. Anthony, thank you very much. Everyone else, thank you for joining us today. Have a good
day.
Bye-bye.